Well, as we've been talking about, Homeland Security wants to test iris scanners, technology that will store digital images of people's eyes in a database that's considered to be a quicker alternative to fingerprints. Is it more privacy invasion? Lots going on. We'll be back with Lauren Weinstein in a moment on Coast to Coast AM, and we'll talk with him about some of these other issues. Well, he turns incredible stories into dramatic stories. Lauren Weinstein has been involved with the development of the Internet for decades. He began his involvement in the early 70s at the first site of the network's ancestor, the Defense Department. Lauren is also an expert regarding a wide range of privacy issues. Here he is for 2 hours on Coast to Coast with our special program on privacy. Hello, Lauren. Welcome back.
Hi, George. How go things this
Good,
evening?
All this morning. We were talking with Catherine a little bit about Google. And you have paid close attention to a story in the news last week about a Google engineer who was apparently dismissed after apparently spying or even stalking some young Google users. Tell me about that.
Yeah. You're referring to Mr. Barksdale, who apparently worked in the Seattle Google office.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, everything we're talking about is alleged at this point, of course, because nothing has been proven, but he has been dismissed. He has been fired.
Yeah, rather than suspended.
Right? Yeah, he's out of there. And apparently what happened is that he had certain privileges in terms of his position that gave him access to actual customer content, the actual private data of Google users that he had as a legitimate part of his job. In terms of maintenance and quality control and such, and the alleged issue here is that he used that ability to access data inappropriately of people, including some minors. Some people have called it stalking. Without knowing all the details, it's impossible to really know at that level. But it does seem that there's a lot of concern that he did use his position and his privileges to access data inappropriately and use it in an inappropriate way. And obviously a lot of people are concerned about that.
Well, how does he get away with it if he doesn't?
Well, the thing is that when you're maintaining large computer networks and massive databases, obviously there's going to be maintenance that's required.
Sure.
Right? Things
all the time.
All the time, continuously. That's part and parcel of the cloud, but not just in the new sense, but just if you're running an ISP where your mail sits before you download it, everything has to be maintained because it's all stored out there somewhere. So the question really becomes, under what conditions does someone have access to that information, and are there sufficient systems and controls and checks to make sure that the probability of someone abusing that kind of access is as low as possible. Now, you're never going to get it down to zero. And I've seen some people, since this story came out, coming up with all kinds of conspiratorial anti-Google claims and such, which strike me as being pretty much lunacy. You can have bad eggs in any company, and that's going to happen, and Google's not the first company that's had that kind of problem. Having said that, though, I think it's in Google's best interest to maintain maximum transparency on something like this. And I'm hoping that they'll come forward with more information about exactly what happened, maybe have a third party look into some of these security issues and do what they can to prevent this this kind of thing in the future. And there are things that can be done. I mean, what some companies do that are in, especially in financial services sectors and things, is sometimes you need multiple people to get at certain data. It takes more than one to access the customer data. Or if only one person can do it, there's an immediate notification. It's the kind of check that makes it hard for someone to abuse data over a period of time, which is what seems to have happened in this case.
Well, and you also seem a little concerned about an article that was in the Wall Street Journal that you say it's kind of scary. It has to do with cookie tracking technology. What is that?
Well, the Wall Street Journal did a study of which sites are using cookies in which ways, and it was a real good study in terms of the logistics of it and how they laid it out. I think it got kind of alarmist in some cases, because when you're talking about cookies on the web, it's a highly technical area, and there's all kinds of ways cookies can be used. There's good ways, there's bad ways. Most of it's about user control. So they were kind of pointing out that there were some sites that have seemingly enormous numbers of cookies. I think they said dictionary.com was the, as I recall, was the winner in terms of however many hundreds of cookies that they used. Now, a lot of those have to do with the ad serving systems, with analytics that are used to figure out how many people are going to the site and all of that. But there are some pretty creepy things that have been coming out recently about cookies. One of the more bizarre ones is something called zombie cookies.
What's that?
And that's something to kind of chill the soul a little bit. Well, as I'm sure you know, in these browsers there are ways to control how cookies are handled. You can determine which sites can set cookies, when you clear them, when you delete them, all these different kinds of parameters that can be set. And apparently what some sites have been doing, and there's a bunch of lawsuits that have now been initiated about this, they've been taking cookies that people have deleted and they've been saving them within the flash players that are on people's computers to mostly display video. That's how most video is being displayed now. Flash has its own kind of cookie storage area. So what these sites were allegedly, again, doing was copying the cookie information into flash storage where it isn't as obvious. Most browsers don't show you that. Google's Chrome will give you access to the flash cookies in an easy way, but most of the others don't. You have to go into flash to do it, and it's kind of complicated. And they would copy these cookies into flash, and then people would delete them saying, well, I don't want those cookies anymore from the main browser, and then the site would go back into the flash cache of cookies again and restore them back to the browser. So they were dead, but they were brought back to life. So that's kind of an abusive kind of thing. And if you run Google's Chrome browser, it's real easy to look in there and see if sites have been doing that. You can look at the cookie cache in flash. Google is not one of the sites that's been abusing cookies in that way, but they do make it easy to go in there and look to see what other sites may have been doing.
The federal government has had a do not call list for some time, and states are backing that up. And you're saying now that there could be a federal government do not track list? What is that?
There are organizations that are pushing this as a concept, and to be honest with you, I'm not in sync with that. The do not call list has been useful in a lot of ways. I mean, I still get a lot of calls, but some people have found it to be pretty effective. But the problem with extending that idea to the web is that web services are not like phone calls. I mean, it's one thing to take one simple phone number and put it on a list, but when you're dealing with web services, you're talking about sometimes people have multiple browsers, they have multiple identities, they're accessing all kinds of different services, and it's very hard technically to come up with a way to just set up a list that would be effective, wouldn't lock you out of services that you want, wouldn't introduce additional privacy problems, because the last thing you probably want to do is put all your identities onto a list that sites have to access just to know not to track you. And on top of it, there's what I call the paying the piper problem, which is we're used to using most of these web services for free.
Nobody would pay for it, I don't think.
And part of the reason that we're able to pay for them for free is the advertising that's there. And while clearly there are some abuses in some situations of how people are being tracked, if you try to attack this with a nuclear weapon, which is what the do not track list would basically be, you run the real risk of cutting off the kind of revenue sources and some legitimate uses of tracking. If it's transparent, it's not necessarily a big problem if you know what's going on and if you can control it. But if you just kill it, you got to start thinking about the fact that you may have to pay for this some other way, pay for these services some other way. So just however I look at it, and I've been criticized for this among some people because there's a lot of, do not track, just like do not call. But really, when you dig into the details of it, it's a real complicated area, and I right now don't see a way to make it work that wouldn't cause an awful lot of collateral damage and probably cause a lot of people to have buyer's remorse if such a thing actually came to pass.
Most people who use their computers, Lauren, probably aren't aware of or are concerned with all these other issues. Would you say that's pretty accurate?
Well, I think most people use their computers to try to get things done.
Right.
I mean, they have a specific thing that they want to do a search, or they want to access their mail, or they want to watch a video, or whatever it is, and they just don't have the time or the inclination to get into all the nitty gritty stuff that's behind it. It's understandable. Most people don't know how to fix their cars. You know, and so it's unreasonable to expect people to be able to deal with all the minutiae of these systems. On the other hand, it's certainly worthwhile for people to be at least generally aware of these issues so that they can research it and deal with them case by case as they come up. Because if you don't, you're at the mercy of your ISP or whoever it is that's giving you internet access.
What do you see right now as the most pressing privacy issue with the internet?
Personally, my main concern is with ISPs, because ISPs have access to every byte of your data.
And explain an ISP.
ISP is the Internet Service Providers. These are the companies through which you get your internet access. In the U.S., the vast majority of people get them from just a handful of companies, because the way we've been structured here,
there's only a few then.
There's
right?
only a few, really, that handle almost everybody, and there's very little true competition in that respect. So these are very powerful companies that are the gateway to the internet. So no matter how big some other company is, every byte you use, every byte you send or receive is going through your ISP.
How do those companies make money, Warren?
Oh, they make the money from their monthly fees that you're paying, right, to get your access to
your
the
access,
internet.
Your access, so somebody pays them, right?
You're paying them so much per month, but increasingly they're trying to get it in other ways, and it's when they start doing that we start running into some of these problems, and this brings us into the realm of net neutrality issues and things like that, because they're not really happy just being access providers. They really want to be content providers too, and that's when they get into competition with people who aren't ISPs. So it gets very complicated at that point and starts to become not only all sorts of interesting economic questions, but political questions.
Is that a monopoly?
Well, monopoly is a formal kind of construct. But in most cities, what you really have is sort of like a duopoly. You usually, if you're lucky, you have maybe the DSL service, or in newer AT&T areas, they'll have UVerse, which is really just DSL, and you'll have maybe the cable company. And so it's like Time Warner or Cox on that side, or AT&T. Or Verizon on the other side. Verizon, of course, has Fios in a lot of areas now, which is fiber, but it's still Verizon. You still these same big companies, and these are the old telephone and cable companies. These are the same names, basically, that go back for decades, except that they have bought each other, and it's become a smaller and smaller universe. At one time, we were trying to break them up, especially the phone companies, but it's sort of like if you remember the
AT&T breakup originally.
And it's all back together again.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like the Terminator. You remember the cop from Terminator. You blow him apart, and then all those blobs of mercury would come back together again.
Southwestern Bell formed after the AT&T breakup as one of the many little spinoff companies, ended up rebuying AT&T.
Right. Which is essentially the child buying the parent, when you really look at it that way. Because they were originally one of the
Baby Bells.
The Baby Bells, the owned companies that were owned by AT&T, and then they ended up taking the AT&T name themselves back. So it's a very strange universe. But the bottom line is that from a consumer standpoint, we're pretty much locked into what the ISPs want to do. And with them so interested in controlling eyeballs now and steering content in their direction, that's what has led us into so many of these very controversial neutrality issues and transparency issues associated with that.
T-Mobile, Sprint, Verizon, companies like that, were they part of the old Baby Bells as landline companies, and then they went heavy into the cell business?
Well, Sprint was a new one. Sprint basically built up their network from scratch. T-Mobile comes from was from Germany. It's still owned by Germany, basically, mostly. So those were really the new guys. But when you look at the others, Verizon has combined in various ways, but originally was General Telephone. If you remember good old General Telephone.
Oh, yeah.
Then GTE, and then Verizon, and then they started buying up other areas in the Northeast. And AT&T has, you know, that's what it's always been, one way or another, in various mix and match combinations. Once again, these are names that go all the way back to the dawn of telephones. You know, AT&T has more than a century of experience in terms of dealing with these kinds of issues, not just technically, but politically as well.
Lauren, you know, the technology continues to move so fast, you know, as they say, doubling every 2 years, maybe even quicker. Where do you see all this in the next 5 or 10 years? Can you look out that far?
I can try, but my crystal ball is as cracked as anyone else's and probably leaking toxic fumes at this point. But the one thing we know for sure is that the Internet is going to be pervasive. I mean, you think it's in a lot of things now and that it's everywhere today. We haven't seen anything yet because it's going to be extending into every kind of possible device, sensors, all kinds of things. So it will be taking over, to the extent it hasn't already, all video, all telephone communications. This will be over a period of years, but it's pretty much inevitable that somewhere down the line, virtually everything that we think of as normal communications capabilities will in one sense or another be part and parcel of the Internet. So that's why a lot of these policy concerns and FCC controversies and things raise so many complicated concerns right now, because people know that it's the way you set it up now that sort of sets the course for a long period of time. And people want to make sure that that's going to be fair, especially to consumers. And, of course, the companies that are providing Internet services want it to be fair to them also, which is understandable.
Is there a possibility that technically one day the Internet will go down in whole for a day, a week, a month? Who knows?
It's really hard for the Internet to actually go down completely, just because of the fundamental design of the Internet, which of course was based on the Defense Department ARPANET, which was a project specifically designed back in the late 60s to try to come up with fault-tolerant networks that would survive breakdowns in one or another of their communications channels or nodes. But there are some pretty serious weak links in the Internet now that have caused some eyebrows to be raised and a lot of sweating in some corners. One of them is the domain name system, which has all kinds of strange aspects to it, because that's turned into a real piggy bank for a lot of organizations, and it doesn't necessarily serve the best interests of consumers in a lot of ways. There's also issues related to the way packets are routed on the network. It gets pretty technical, but there have been situations already where one country would try to make a local routing change in the way they're on the Internet. They make a mistake in the way they do it, and suddenly a whole part of the world is cut off from major services because of a typing error, basically, on the other side of the world. So taking the whole thing down is pretty difficult, but there are certainly ways to gum it up pretty badly on a region-by-region basis. And some of these are very difficult to solve. I mean, there's people working on a lot of them, but these aren't turnkey situations where you can go in and fix them very easily.
People would be lost without it now, Lauren. They'd be lost without the Internet.
Yeah, it would be pretty hopeless now. And there's so much that people don't even realize is on the Internet now. I mean, just in terms of intercompany communications, the flow of data between banks and
the use of smartphones,
all of these things. So it's really become the backbone of all communications rapidly, you know, in the developed world, certainly in the developing world, very, very rapidly now. And that's not going to change.
Lauren, when we come back, let's talk about Twitter, Facebook, and what Craigslist has been up to. And then we'll take phone calls next hour on Coast to Coast AM. You know, the After Dark magazine is the official magazine of Coast to Coast AM. It comes out every month, full color. You can order it by calling 1-888-261-6392, or you can just go online at coasttocoastam.com. By the way, it would make a great little holiday Christmas gift, which is only now a few months away. Can you believe that? Well, we'll be back in a moment more with Lauren Weinstein, and we'll take your phone calls next hour with them on Coast to Coast AM. Lauren, Twitter, Facebook, of course, the great social networks keeping very busy. But is it true that people are posting their locations and crooks are robbing them?
Yeah, there's anecdotal evidence to that effect. I'm not sure that we have any very specific cases that can really be pinned down, but at least theoretically, it's a concern that people need to be thinking about. Because if you publicly are telling the world, and I think that's the key thing, if you're telling a confined group of people, a selected group, that's one thing. But if you're publicly stating, hey, I'm going on vacation for 2 weeks, and it's obvious where you live, or you've posted that in some other place where it can be easily found, or maybe on your Facebook page even, then that does seem like kind of an invitation. It just doesn't make a lot of sense from that standpoint, even if you're just going out for dinner. Now, obviously, this is a kind of individualistic kind of, individualistic situation, because people have different sensitivity to telling other people where they're going and for how long and such. But just common sense sort of says that telling everyone that you're not going to be around is kind of asking for trouble. So that's an area where definite care is probably suggested.
And you know, they are fueling, I think, the sales of smartphones, the social network sites, and everything else. I mean, these phones have become communication devices for people. And if you don't have one, it's strange. People think you're a dinosaur. Somebody called me one once.
You mean because of that 10-year-old Nokia?
I didn't have the antenna that pulled out.
Yeah, it's the pull-out antenna.
Yeah, I didn't have one of those.
Well, I think we're getting to a point now pretty rapidly where most phones that are sold now are going to start to fall into the smartphone category. It's not going to be that niche that seemed so high altitude and so strange. It's going to be pretty much standard that most cell phones are going to have some kind of smartphone capability. There's reasons for that, of course, because it's some of those capabilities that have the revenue enhancement, revenue attracting features that not only the cell phone companies want, but their various partners and internet sites and things like that. Whether they all have to have a fancy color display and a keyboard, a pull-out keyboard and such, isn't necessarily the issue. But the basic ability to do textual communications, to be able to access websites, to have a basic web browser in them at least, things like that, I think are going to become pretty much standard.
Yeah, that could be too. Craigslist, what's happening there?
Well, there's been a lot of controversy over their adult services section. And I should mention, starting on this, just as full disclosure, that Craig Newmark, who was the founder of Craigslist, though he doesn't really run the company anymore, he's pretty much semi-retired, but he's a signatory to my net neutrality squad project. So just want to make that clear.
All right. Okay.
We've never talked about any of these issues relating to Craigslist and adult services. But the problem has been that there are mostly state's attorneys generals that have been really coming after Craigslist, saying, well, you shouldn't have these adult services because there's people that advertise prostitution and other things like that on Craigslist in the adult services section. And they've been demanding that Craigslist shut that section down.
Well, they did, right?
And ultimately they did. But it's not at all clear that really changes much of anything, because as Craigslist has pointed out many times, the kinds of materials that were in their adult services sections can be found in newspapers that are on vending stands on corners of just about every city in the country, often even more explicit and harder. This is really an important point, harder for law enforcement to monitor, because at least with Craigslist, they had set up a system where people who wanted to place adult services ads had to have a confirmable phone number. They had to pay a special fee. It was easy. It was all in one place for local law enforcement to go through them. By cutting out that section, all you really do is cause those kinds of things that law enforcement wants to monitor to spread out. They just diffuse out into other areas that are less obvious and not as concentrated. And they're still going to be there, but now they're even harder to control. And the law was really clear on this. I mean, the law says that Craigslist is not responsible for those ads, just like a newspaper isn't responsible, as long as they're taking reasonable steps, which they were doing. So as far as I'm concerned, this has all been pretty much a political stage show. It's attorney generals in various states that thought that Craigslist was an easy target. And while nobody wants to say, well, you know, there's not a problem with prostitution being listed in something like this, to go after Craigslist specifically strikes me as being a misuse of resources. There's some people who would argue, well, you know, there's freedom of speech issues in this also, and I think that's partly true. I don't think the existence of those ads really added a lot of value to Craigslist for most people.
If anything, it cheapened.
Yeah, I think that can definitely be asserted. But on the other hand, I'm a freedom of speech kind of guy, and to see political figures in various states using Craigslist as a whipping boy for their own purposes,
right?
Especially when we know that in the end, those services are still going to be around in other venues, I think was disingenuous at least. And I think Craigslist overall got a pretty bum rap on this whole thing.
How did Craigslist and how does Craigslist make money?
Well, most of the ads are free. I think that now this is something you would have to check, you know, with them about. But I think the real estate ads in particular, I think, are not free. That's one thing for sure. The adult services section was not free, but that was only done to try to provide a way to verify the people who are placing the ads, because they would have to use a credit card normally to do that. So that provided an ID check for people, another way for law enforcement to help be able to track those ads down. But generally, of course, as far as most consumers are concerned, at least non-real estate, the ads are free. And they don't make it. See, the other thing about Craigslist that's kind of interesting is that could have been turned into a much, much bigger money-making operation many years ago. I mean, if they wanted to really monetize that thing, it could have been bringing in just bundles of money more than it is now. But that hasn't really been the interest of the company, as I understand it.
It's amazing how much some of these Internet sites are making, though, isn't it? My gosh.
Well, you know, it's all a matter of people being able to choose, you know, how they want to spend their money, and as far as I'm concerned, it's all about transparency. I mean, I use the word a lot because it's the old sunlight is the best disinfectant kind of viewpoint. I want people to have maximum choice, and I want them to understand what they're doing and what they're getting into, and then it's up to them to decide. Now, that doesn't mean you don't have to have regulation to make sure that everyone's playing the same game by the same rules, and there isn't various kinds of subterfuge going on. But generally, it's best, whenever possible, to try to let these kinds of sites, you know, operate on a self-regulatory basis if there's sufficient competition. And that's why you'll find a lot of people, including me, arguing that ISPs, for example, where there's only very limited effective competition, especially from a cost speed standpoint, really need to be in a more rigorous regulatory regime than they are now, which is basically hardly any at all.
What's the latest with technology in terms of hardware? What's coming out that'll blow people away? Do you know?
Oh, gee, it's onward and upward, right? I mean, I think one of the interesting areas, especially outside the metropolitan, the big cities, that's going to be coming along. And the FCC is supposed to be perhaps ruling on this in the next couple of days, I think, is something called white spaces. This is a way, you know, one of the problems we have now is we have all these wireless devices, right? And that's your Wi-Fi hub at home and your cell phone and everything else. And they're basically competing for fairly narrow slices of spectrum. The same spectrum that's used to send out, you know, the show, for example. And in general, to get hold of new spectrum, it's required large chunks of money. I mean, the amount of money that the cell phone companies have paid for new spectrum is absolutely astronomical. And part of the reason for that is it was turned into auctions that were used to help balance the budget before the auctions even really had taken place. So there was some interesting sleight of hand, you know, congressional sleight of hand going on with that some years back. But the spectrum crunch is such that it's very hard to come up with new devices, for example, to transmit data, you know, between devices in the home and things like that. So what's happened is that there's been a big push, and there's been a lot of pushback on it also, to start freeing up the spectrum that's unused. So, for example, in most cities, you don't have a digital TV station in every possible slot where there could be one. Now, in L.A., they're almost all filled, but in most areas, they're not. So you really want to have a way for devices to be smart enough to say, hey, I want to communicate, and let's look right now, and let's look in a database and see where there's some open spectrum in this area and be able to use it, even if that spectrum isn't available in some other city. And it's controversial because there are vested interests that don't want that to happen. Part of it is concerns of broadcasters who are concerned about the interference, and there are legitimate concerns there, but I think the technology can deal with that. People with wireless microphones have concerns, but I think it's a technology that has a great deal of potential. We're going to see it used in all kinds of interesting ways, and I think you'll hear something about that in the news pretty shortly.
All right, Lauren, what are you working on these days? What's new with you?
I try to keep my head above water here. You know, basically.
You don't want to keep it underwater, that's for sure.
Yeah, along with everyone else, you know, trying to stay up on top of these issues now, especially when the technology has gotten so politicized. I mean, this is something that I find very, very disconcerting. It bothers me a lot when what should be technical issues that you approach logically are turned into kind of political footballs in a lot of cases. And
everybody has their own agenda, Lauren, huh?
Yeah, well, it that's understandable, but you know, there are technical realities to these things. And I'm basically a technical guy who kind of got dragged into policy over a long period of years. And I still look at this and I kind of shake my head sometimes when I see some of the arguments that are made that are just very illogical from my standpoint, but serve certain political purposes. So that's something that kind of sticks in my craw.
Well, you know, it's just this technology thing. You have to keep up on it. I think it's an advantage for you. I think new CEOs coming into corporations, if they don't keep abreast of this and all the technological changes and what's happening, I think they're going to be like out the pasture, don't you?
Yeah, they certainly will be, and there's areas now where this is coming up pretty fast, where I think a lot of companies aren't really aware of what's going to be coming down the pipe. Medical technology is one related area, of course. Medical health records, all these kinds of things are going to be very, very important, and I think that hospitals and doctors and just ordinary people who don't stay abreast of what's coming on that are going to find themselves at a disadvantage over the next few years.
What do you think the demographics are of computer usage and certain software like, you know, the Twitter and the Facebook?
Yeah, it's very interesting. The common perception is that social networking, think about Twitter and Facebook in particular, Google Buzz is another one that I use a fair bit now. That it's a young person's game. But what we're finding is more and more older people, I guess, like you and me, are more and more getting involved in it because we find it's a very good way to stay in contact with the people we work with or that deal with personally. Now, there are some interesting differences in how they're used. So a younger person may be more likely to be using Twitter, for example, or Facebook to communicate, you know, what they're doing right now and where they're going and all these kinds of things. A lot of older people tend to use these for more as a news clipping service. I tend to use Twitter a lot. My Twitter account is just Lauren Weinstein. And I tend to send out items that I think are interesting or that I think are worthwhile for people. I don't really say a lot. I don't say what I ate for lunch or anything like that. So I think we're seeing that the usage is ramping up all across the spectrum in terms of ages. But the specific way that it's used in different demographics is probably going to continue to look different, you know, based on the stage of life you're in and what interests you at most at that point.
Yeah, well, that's probably true, too. I mean, it is remarkable how quickly it moves by. Could you get by without a computer now?
No.
No.
No, no, that's pretty, it's hopeless. I've been at this for so for so long now that if someone took away my email, I'd be pretty devastated.
You'd be lost, wouldn't you?
Yeah, it's pretty much impossible. It's kind of interesting now because, you know, the volume of, in terms of number of phone calls that are being made is really starting to drop now in terms of personal phone calls because so many people now switched.
Yeah.
They've switched to using text messages or email or the various social networking services. That there's people who don't actually make a voice phone call sometime for weeks at a time, but they're still in constant communication through these other text, you know, text-based technologies. So that's a real sea change, and what impacts that really mean? You know, what kind of impact that's going to have in terms of social policy and emotional involvement and all these other things is going to be something to probably keep sociologists and maybe psychiatrists busy for a long time.
Well, look what it has done to the newspaper business. It's crippled it.
Yeah, the physical newspaper business is probably not a growth industry right now. The whole model has been pretty much decimated by the internet. Nor is it clear that some of the kinds of techniques that have been suggested for dealing with it are going to work. As you may know, Rupert Murdoch has been pushing the establishment of what are called paywalls, where you'd have to pay to access his websites or as many websites as he could get into his consortium. And other sites are experimenting with this, too. I think there's a problem there, which is that basically it appears that most people are only really willing to pay for access to news on websites if it's special purpose, like financial information or something like that, and it's important to professionally.
Very niche.
Yeah. Otherwise, it's the kind of thing. A lot of news is a commodity kind of thing where it's just not worth it to you to pay, especially if you have to do it on a site by site basis. If you have to pay for a subscription to this newspaper and another one for this newspaper, it really starts to add up. There may be models that will evolve, you know, ways to monetize this that will evolve over time. There's some interesting ones, but a lot of them sort of depend on the development of what are called micropayment systems, where you could easily make very, very small payments. And basically none of those have ever panned out. There have been a number of tries at it, and none of them have really been successful. So I'm concerned that some of these newspapers that think that they can just put up a paywall and then people will just, you know, will just start running up to put their coins in the slot, the virtual slot on their computers, I think they could be in real trouble. And if that happens, we could lose a lot of major sources of information. Just in the last couple of days, there have been people that have moved from, there's one major reporter who moved from Newsweek to Huffington Post, and another one, I think today was announced, from the New York Times to Huffington Post. And that just sort of gives you a
probably for more money.
Probably more money, or maybe just thinking that they have more job security.
Yeah, well, they're pretty smart on both ends. Lauren, we'll be back in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. We're going to take phone calls with you in the final hour. Lauren, his website, vortex.com.